Good evening, everybody. Glad to see all of you and glad to know that we've got folks online. We always have folks watching with us online, joining us in class. This is a class on the Gospel of Luke. Tonight we're going back into chapter 9. We read quite a bit last week, and so when we get through our review questions, we'll go right into the text, and then maybe when we finish discussing the part of the text we read last week, the last part, we'll, after that, read some more and talk some more about that. But first, what question did Jesus ask the apostles regarding the people? This is from last week. Who do the people say that I am? That was his question. What were some of the answers that they gave? One? John the Baptist? Who else? Elijah, which makes sense because John came in the spirit and power of Elijah. So there must have been some similarity between Jesus and John in their preaching and their approach. And who else? One of the prophets, just one of the prophets. Was Jesus any of those? He was not. Don't go by what the people say. There's a lesson in there. Who'd he ask next? Peter. And Peter said, "You are the Christ, Son of the living God." So what two things did Jesus tell the apostles after Peter confessed he was the Christ? Two things, he said. And you can look in the text. That's not cheating. And if you're telling me, I'm not hearing it. Told him not to tell anybody. Yes. Don't tell anybody. That's the signal right there. What else did he tell him? He's going to suffer a lot of things and he's going to die. Look in chapter 9. We'll just take a quick glance at that. Verse 21. He warned them and instructed them not to tell this to anyone. That's Peter saying that he was the Christ. And then he said in verse 22, the Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected by the elders and chief priests, scribes, and be killed and be raised up the third day. First time it's recorded that he is telling them this information, giving them this information. And a little later on, maybe we'll get a clue as to why they don't see it, but that's something worthy of discussion as well. Number three, what did Jesus say a man must do to save his life? Give it up. Crucify yourself. This is chapter 9 as well, verse 23. If anyone wishes to come after me, he's got to deny himself, take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life is going to lose it, but if you lose your life for my sake, that's the guy that'll save it. It's so based on faith. What did God say after Peter suggested building three tabernacles? This is at the Transfiguration. Peter said, "Wow, it's great to be here. Let's build three tabernacles for you, Moses, and Elijah." And God said, "This is my beloved son. Listen to him." Listen to him. The focus is on Jesus. All right. Anybody got anything you want to look over? I don't know why I put this up there because we aren't going to do that reading yet. We're going to go over to chapter 9, the latter part, where it says in verse 37, on the next day, when they came down from the mountain, what mountain? Mountain where Jesus was transfigured. He was changed. They came down from that mountain, and a man from the crowd shouted, saying, "Teacher, I beg you, look at my son. He's my only boy." And a spirit seizes him and suddenly screams, throws him into the convulsion, and he's foaming at the mouth. And only with difficulty does it leave him, mauling him as it leaves. "I beg your disciples to cast it out," and they could not. And Jesus said, unbelieving. Why would he say that? Okay.
To cast out.
Okay. But they're coming to him. This guy's coming to him anyway.
Yeah.
So there's got to be some level of faith. When he was saying unbelieving, what is he addressing? What do you think? He doesn't just say unbelieving. What else does he say?
Perversion.
Unbelieving and perverse. Who must he be talking about? He's got to be talking about, correct me if you think I'm mistaken, he's got to be talking about the guys who attempted to cast out the demon and were unable. So we got some guys trying to do a good thing, we might assess, and Jesus calls them faithless and perverted. Write it down. Jesus always sees things as they actually are. We might want to give the benefit of the doubt. He doesn't have to worry about giving the benefit of the doubt. Why? Why do we give the benefit of the doubt? We give the benefit of the doubt because we know we don't know. So we're going to try to be generous. But Jesus, he knows. Faithless. Perverse. There was some degree of faithlessness, some degree of perversity that was preventing these guys from casting this demon out. Look how it plays out. Verse 42. While he was still approaching, the demon slammed him to the ground and threw him into a convulsion. But Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed the boy and gave him back to his father. Wouldn't you like to have heard that rebuke?
In the gospel, God heals us and gives us back to the Father.
Restoration. That's what God is always all about. In Genesis chapter 3, the bond between God and man was broken, and ever since that time, God has been working to bring about restoration. This is also somewhat poetic. What did Malachi say? But Malachi was saying this about John the Baptist. The last few verses of the Old Testament, as we have the books organized, you go back to the last few verses of Malachi, and this is what it says. Behold, I'm going to send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. He will restore the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers, so that I will not come and smite the land with a curse. This is what John came to do, to reunite fathers and children, parents and children, because, and he doesn't say why, but why do you think why? What's the basis of human civilization as we know it, but the family unit? I'm not trying to get political. I'm not trying to get ideological. I'm trying to get doctrinal. What does Marxism seek to destroy?
Family.
The family unit. You have no individual rights. You belong to the whole, to the state. That's what Marxism is all about. And so when somebody says to you, well, communism's not that bad if you do it right, just smack them. Yeah, if the Nazis had maybe done this or done that, no. There's just enough truth in some things to make you think, it might work. No. Not trying to get political, but you take a look deep into everything like that you hear, and you see what's at the basis of it. And if it's not God, get away from it. Did you think we'd be having a discussion like this regarding this fellow and his demon? Jesus says, while everyone was marveling at all that he was doing, he said to his disciples, let these words sink into your ears. For the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. Is there any connection between him casting out a demon and saying to them, let this sink into your ears. The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hand of men. He just told them that previously, just a little bit ago, the day before, looked like. Okay. What's he shown power over so far? Just think about the text, the history that we've been given. What's he done with the bread? Multiplied the bread, multiplied the fish. What did he do in the boat? Calm the sea. What does he do with the demons? He just did it with this demon. They couldn't cast him out because they were faithless and perverted, but he comes in and he just says, get on your way, demon, and the demon's gone. And Jesus gives the boy back to his father, and then he says this, Son of Man's going to be delivered into the hands of men. How could you, someone with that kind of power, how could he be delivered over to the hands of men, mere men, when he controls the wind and the sea and the waves, and he controls the elements to recreate food and fish and bread, and he controls the demons to tell them which way to go? How's the only way he could be delivered over to the hands of men? If he allowed it. If he allowed it. And that was his plan from the get-go. So here we are. Yes?
Heard a voice.
Well, I mean, the next verse says it was concealed from them, so they didn't understand it. Now, I don't know if it was because, you know, sometimes the Bible words things like, he hardens Pharaoh's heart. But really, you know, we know it's Pharaoh's problem, you know. And here it may be, too, that it's their problem. But it says it was concealed from them, so they didn't understand it, and they were afraid to ask him.
Right.
So I don't know.
For me, there's a clue in chapter 24. What Don's talking about is the last part of verse 45. It says, it was concealed from them so that they would not perceive it, and they were afraid to ask him about this statement. So they don't understand it, but they not only don't understand it, there is a fear in their minds about asking him, and it doesn't say if the fear came from God like the concealment did or what. But if you look at chapter 24, after the resurrection, Jesus is walking along with two guys going to Emmaus. I always think of Disney World for some reason. That's just the weird dad part of me, I guess. About 7 miles from Jerusalem, they were talking with each other about all these things which had taken place. This is Luke 24 and verse 14. Well, now 15. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself approached and began traveling with them. But their eyes were prevented from recognizing him. And he said to them, what are these words which you're exchanging with one another? And what'd they say to him? Man, how can you be so clueless? How can you not know what's been going on? The one came that we thought was the Messiah, and he was crucified. And then now it's been said that he is resurrected from the dead. And then you get a little farther along. I think it's verse 33. Where does it say it? Nope, not verse 33. That's too far. Verse 25. Verse 25, he says to them, O foolish men, and slow of heart to believe in all that the prophets have spoken. Now, to me, there's a connection, and I don't have that other verse to prove it, but I think there's a connection. He's calling them foolish. He's calling them slow of heart. Now, these are disciples. They're not apostles, because later on it'll say they went and they told the apostles, the 11. So these are not apostles, but they're disciples, and they seem to be really upset over what's happened with Jesus, and he's walking along with them as the resurrected Christ, and they don't recognize him because it's withheld from them to recognize him. But then we're told that they are what? Foolish and slow of heart. Is that the reason, I wonder, why it was withheld from them, because they really didn't have the faith to see it. And so I see this also back in chapter 9, where it's withheld from the apostles to see what Jesus is talking about. And I wonder if that has anything to do with it. But I'm also thinking this, and Jesus, this will be better brought out in John's gospel, but Jesus tells them things that they don't get, but they do remember. And then after the resurrection, they go back, oh yeah, that's right, he told us this. And it is all the more reason for them to believe now, because they realize he told us that a long time ago, and it's come to pass. It's like this is one more sign. And one of the things you notice, especially in John's gospel, I know we're not in John's gospel, but it all goes together, is people who believe are said, and they believed. They already believe, but when they see this, and they believed. Well, what's that all about? It's like the evidence is there, and you're believing, but now you believe a little bit more. And there's not a, you can't unbutton your shirt and look down, see a little gauge that says faith. Faithometer. It's down kind of in the red, but it's moving up a little bit. And I want it to go all the way over, but Jesus says, oh, you're a faithless generation. Oh, no, all the way back. You're perverse. Oh, no, I don't want to be faithless and perverse, but I am. I am. Help my unbelief. And Jesus is saying, listen, I multiply the bread and the food and the fish. I tell the wind and the waves what to do. I command the demons what to do, but I am going to be delivered over to men. And I'm going to be put to death. I'm going to be raised on the third day. And they didn't get it. Dean? Or Lee?
I think they could deal with these physical things and see his power. But I think the more the spiritual, the eternal part of him would have confused him, maybe frightened him. You know, he said he's going to be killed.
Right.
This is from Christ. I see it. Real problem until things come to fruition.
Not only have they not seen anything like that before, well, they have seen resurrection, but not the way they're going to see it with him. They don't want to see that. They don't want to believe that this is going to happen. He's going to be killed. Humanity, you are a complex being. Each one of us are. And we are struggling to know and understand God. And that's why we're here tonight. We're looking into his word to try to figure some things out and see what's Jesus got to say to us here. What will the Spirit reveal? And maybe I won't see as much as I want to see tonight, but maybe I'll see something that later on will turn out to have been a seed that will spring forth and do something. That's why it's so valuable to study. Even when you close it up, you go, I don't understand what that meant. Well, you got just a little bit closer. How many days did you go to school as a kid and say, I didn't learn nothing today, and you really did. Larry and then Don.
Maybe he keeps talking to them about it to get them to think about it, to get them to realize what he's talking about.
In my mind, he's trying to prepare them, because sometimes you just have to be told some things over and over and over again before you finally get it. I know your kids weren't that way, but some people's children, I've read about children that are like that. You just got to keep telling them things. And they still don't get it. It's my mom told me, you'll never understand how much I love you until you have your own children. Up here, I knew that that has to be true. But I didn't know it in here until we had our children. It's a different thing. And I think they saw things very differently after the resurrection than they did before the resurrection. Don?
Back up a little bit to that faithlessness thing, and I may be reading too much into it, but I was using the parallel. When he tells them that they were faithless, you know, in Mark 9, he says, he gets down to the bottom of it, when he ends it, he said, why couldn't we cast this out? He said, well, this only can be done by prayer. And so I try to think about that a little bit. I'm thinking, you know, it's I'm not maybe reading too much into this, but Jesus had given them the power to cast out demons and things. And perhaps, you know, it's got, well, he's given us the power, we're going to go do it. Instead of, you know, in the Bible, I forget what it is, it says pray unceasingly.
Right.
Jesus said, without me, you can't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And their attitude may have been, well, he's given us the power, but we're going to go do it. And now they can't do it because they're not really in their, you know, I don't know that you need to run over, kneel down, pray before God, and then do it, you know, but at least in your heart, as we're supposed to be walking with God every day, the Lord every day, constantly, you know, praying unceasingly. And so their attitude may not have been one of, Lord, let us do this, you know, can't. We want to do this, even if it's just a quick thought or whatever. You know, the attitude is whatever we go do in the Lord's name, we should be, at least in our hearts, be thinking, I need your help in this. You know, it's not me. I don't want to just obey you to be good enough. I want to, you know, we need to be talking to him.
Right.
So maybe that was something. I may be reading too much into it, but he said they were faithless, and maybe they wasn't calling on the name of the Lord to do it, you know.
Well, it makes me wonder, because how many times have you reprimanded yourself because you were trying to do something that you knew was really important, and then finally after getting frustrated and more frustrated, you realize, I've never asked God about this. I've never asked him to help me to get this accomplished or help me to see the wisdom of what I'm doing or whatever. One of the things, I mean, when you look at Joshua, wait a minute, we're in Luke, we're talking about Joshua, okay. They're outside of Jericho, big city, walled city, powerful city. God says, here's what I want you to do. March around it, blow the horns, it'll fall down. That's what happened. What's the next town? It's hard to spell.
Ai.
That's how you spell it. Ai. What does Joshua say about Ai? Just take a few guys up there and wipe that place out. Does he ask God? Nothing. What happens at Ai? They get a shellacking. And they, oh, Lord, the fall on their face. It's like God says, stop groveling and get up. And here's what I want you to do. And it's just a matter of who do we put our faith in? You got the power. And remember what they... We'll see this later. He'll send out the 70. As he's going to Jerusalem, he sends out the 70 to go ahead of him into the towns and preach the gospel. And when they come back, what do they say? They're excited because the demons are being cast out. They've got the power over the demons. And what does Jesus say to them? He said, I'll tell you what's better than that. Your names are written in heaven. It's like we're always kind of getting it wrong. We've always got our priorities messed up. But wow, demons. You got power over demons. How fantastic is that? Well, it's more fantastic if your name's written in heaven. When you're reading through 1 Corinthians and you get to chapter 12 of 1 Corinthians and he's enumerating all the miraculous gifts, not simply spiritual gifts, but miraculous gifts. And then he gets down to the end of chapter 12. How does he end chapter 12? You can look at it if you want. It's not cheating. And yet I show you a more excellent way. A more excellent way than what? A more excellent way than the ability to do all these miracles. What's the more excellent way in chapter 13 of 1 Corinthians? Love. That's the more excellent way. Wait, how can that be? How can love be better than miracles? I can't do miracles, but I can love people. And God says, you're finally starting to get it, boy. You're finally starting to get it. That's what I want you to do. And so when you see religious folks put the focus on the miraculous, there's a level of immaturity there. When Jesus talked about the weightier things of the law, what did he mention as the weightier things of the law? He talked about justice, mercy, faithfulness. He's already talked about love. Those are the kinds of things that are heavy, that are important to God. Those are the kinds of things that he's trying to get across to them and trying to get across to us. And they, like us, are getting wrapped up in the stuff that's really sensational and powerful and different because we can't do that. We've never seen that. And he's saying it's just basic stuff. Care about people, love people, serve people. That's what godliness is in this world. So, yeah. Did I miss a hand? Anybody?
I
All right. Let's go to, we're not going to, I know I told you initially we would be skipping sections because of time. We're only going to skip a little bit there. We're going to go down to verse 51. I need somebody to read 51 through 56 and then 57 to 62 here in chapter 9. We'll finish it out. So who wants 51 to 56? Anybody? All right, Robert, and then Rich, if you would get the last section, 57 to 62. Thank you, guys.
When the days were approaching for his ascension, he was determined to go to Jerusalem, and he sent messengers on ahead of him, and they went and entered a village of the Samaritans to make arrangements for him. And they did not receive him because he was traveling toward Jerusalem. When his disciples James and John saw this, they said, "Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them?" But he turned and rebuked them, and they went on to another village.
And starting at 57.
As they were going along the road, someone said to him, "I will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said to him, "The foxes have holes, and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere." And he said to another, "Follow me." But he said, "Lord, permit me first to go and bury my father." But he said to him, "Allow the dead to bury their own dead. But as for you, go and proclaim everywhere the kingdom of God." Another also said, "I will follow you, Lord, but first permit me to say goodbye to those at home." But Jesus said to him, "No one, after putting his hand on the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God."
All right. Thank you, guys. So when the days were approaching for what? His ascension. It's interesting that Luke doesn't mention the arrest, the crucifixion. He goes straight to the ascension. The rising, the days are approaching for that. He's looking past all that at this point. For whatever reason, the Holy Spirit had him to write it down that way. So he was determined to go to Jerusalem. And when they got to the Samaritans, what did the Samaritans say? "You going to Jerusalem? We don't want you here. You're not welcome." You see the irony? What's he going to Jerusalem to do? To die for the Samaritans, for them and for me. And you remember in Acts when Jesus tells the apostles, "You go wait for me in Jerusalem till you receive power from on high. And after that, you're going to be my witnesses." Where? In Jerusalem, in Judea, and Samaria, and to the uttermost parts of the earth. And then you get to chapter 8, Philip. The church is scattered by the persecution, and Philip winds up in Samaria, and he's preaching the gospel, and he's baptizing people because they're believing the message of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. It's like, you would read this and you might get angry, but just keep reading. Look on past it. Wait for the time. It's coming. The preaching is going to be done here in the same place, and people, maybe some of these same people, I don't know, are going to hear that preaching and they're going to obey it. Remember that woman at the well? Where was she from? Samaritan woman. She meets Jesus, goes back into town, tells everybody, and this woman that we would think wouldn't be an influence in anybody's life gets the whole town to come out. And what do they say? "Now we believe in you, not because of what the woman said, but because we've seen it for ourselves." So it's like, yeah, this looks really bad for the Samaritans here, but redemption's coming. Redemption is coming. All in good time. So what did the apostles, these spiritually minded, godly apostles, want to do? Bring fire down. It's in the Bible. Elijah did it. Why can't we? Should we call fire down from heaven? And Jesus says, no, it's not the plan. Not the plan. Didn't come to kill men. Came to save them. That's why he's on his way to Jerusalem, and they just went on to another village. And sometimes that's what you and I need to do. Instead of stopping when the devil's dogs bark, just walk on by. Walk on by. 57. As they're going down the road, someone said to him, I'll follow you wherever you go. And what's he say to this guy? Oh, I'm so glad to have a follower. I've been looking for people who have followed me. I've been looking for people who have put their faith. I'm so happy to see you. It's not what he says. He puts a challenge in front of them. Foxes have holes. Birds have nests. I don't have any place to lay my head. What's he saying to this person? You better be sure you want to make this commitment. If any man comes after me, let him do what? That's what he said back in chapter 9 a little earlier. Let him deny himself. Take up his lazy boy. Take up his cross and follow me. And now think about it. He's going through Samaria and the Samaritans say, get out of here. We don't want you. And then these people come up the opposite. Oh, we want to follow you wherever you go. And he doesn't say, oh, man, I'm so glad to meet people like you. Man, those Samaritans, that's pretty rough in Samaria. He doesn't say that. He says, you better think about it. You want to follow me. This is the way it's going to be. Jesus is not worried about selling himself to people. He just wants to get the truth out there so people can make their own minds up about what they want to do with their souls based on him. John and then Bud.
When it says, by taking up your bow and not looking back, is that referring to not regretting your decision that you took on and stick with it and go? Or, well, I mean, I'm not really sure exactly the intent.
I think he's putting a stake in the sand and he says, this is it. Either I'm the Messiah or I'm not. Remember, Luke didn't write it out this way. He didn't write everything that Matthew wrote. But when they confessed that Jesus was the Christ, and then later on he taught some things that upset some people and they left, and Jesus asked them the question, the apostles, will you also leave? What did they say? To whom shall we go? You're the one with words of eternal life. There isn't anybody else but you. If we will come to that conclusion and remember that and stick to it, we're going to be okay. That's what Jesus is trying to get established in our minds and hearts, that he is the Christ. He is the Messiah. He is the one who can deliver us from our own sin. And it's not going to be the way you think it's going to be. It's going to be better, but not what you expect. This is why Peter, I'm convinced this is why Peter in the garden, instead of saying, oh, I'm glad these soldiers are here, Jesus, because I know this is what you said would happen, so I'm going to step back and let it happen. What does Peter do? Pulls out his sword, lops off an ear, and Jesus says, put your sword up. He heals Malchus and lets it play out just like it's supposed to play out. Bud?
I was just going to say that I answered a question tonight. Someone says, have you confirmed your doctor's appointment? I said, no, I haven't. Well, do you have an appointment? Well, I don't know. I know that I want to. In other words, I want to confirm what I want to happen, but sometimes I forget about getting that confirmation, you know. In other words, we want to believe in Christ, and we think that we believe in Christ, but yet we're acting like we don't believe in Christ. And so what we have to do is get a confirmation for ourselves, yes, Christ is the real Christ.
When I get on a roller coaster, oh, here we go. I know I'm not going to fly out of it, because if people were flying out of roller coasters, there'd be lawsuits left and right, and you'd see all the bodies laying down there when you get on. Little skeletons down there. Oh, what happened to that guy? Oh, he fell out on the loop-de-loop up there. Even though I know I'm not going to fall out of that thing, what do? My knuckles are white. I am not going to let go. You ride that thing down in Disney World. What's it called? The Space Mountain. It's all black inside. You can't see. And you're going real fast, and you're coming up on things that looks like that's going to smack my head wide open. I know there's guys bigger, taller than me that ride that thing, and you know they make that so that nobody's ever going to get hit. But I'm still doing this, holding on for dear life and doing this. And you get off, you go, whew, well, that was fun. You just take whatever extra steps you need to take. And Jesus is saying, I want you to believe in me. I want you to have so much faith that you can have comfort in following what I do and not feel like somehow in life you're going to miss out if you don't dabble in sin. It's like the devil says, oh man, you don't know what fun you're missing. And God is saying, you don't know what greatness you'll miss, what glory you'll miss. And Jesus is rejected in Samaria, accepted here among these people, but these people, he says, you need to understand, this is what it's going to be like if you follow me. It will all pay off, but you need to know this going in.
Where they talk about, you put your hand to the plow and then look back.
Right.
Is that basically the same thing in Revelations 2 where they're talking about the church in Ephesus? They've lost their first love.
It's probably related. It's probably also related to Laodicea, where they become lukewarm. Has anybody here ever actually plowed? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Y'all who have plowed, what happens when you look back? This way, that way. I did have one old timer say, you can go just as much corn in a crooked furrow as you can in a straight one. Well, okay, but the point is, you put your hand to the plow, what had you better be doing? You better be plowing. I saw it today on the way here this evening at an intersection. I wait for a guy who's taking too much time to take his turn and get across, and he finally gets across, and I can see now through the tinted windows, what's he doing? He's on the phone. What?
Sorry.
Time to quit. It's like you better be driving. If you're in your car, you better be driving. That's how bad things happen. And Jesus is saying, if you're going to follow me, you better be following me. You better think about this. I've already said, you want to follow me, you got to take up your cross and follow me every day carrying that cross. That cross is what you die on. You want to follow me, you got to understand the foxes have holes, the birds of the nest of the air have nests. I don't have a place to lay my head. You want to follow me, you put your hand to the plow, you better not look back. Wow, he's kind of hard. Right.
You got to follow that mule.
Beautiful view. Yes.
I like to watch a lot. This is about following Jesus, and no matter what. You know.
Right.
And when I'm watching a TV show, I like to watch a lot of World War II stuff. And I always relate it to, you know, when I'm watching that stuff, I relate it to the decisions. What if I was in that situation, the decision I might need to make? I just watched two shows recently. There's a million shows that I do this to. The last two, one was Saints and Soldiers. And it turned out that one of these American soldiers, they were fighting their way. They were behind enemy lines and trying to fight their way out. And one of them could speak German, and his own troops was getting a little upset. Why can't he speak German? He said, well, I used to be a missionary in Germany before the war, and I taught these people. And so I don't hate them. I mean, I'm fighting them because it's against them, but I don't hate them. If you need to hate them to kill them, that's up to you. But I don't hate these people, you know. And then it turned out, you know, this German guy, I don't know, they capture one of these German guys, and all of a sudden he goes, Rudy. And he starts speaking German to him, and it was the guy he had taught. And he's fighting on the German side, and he's fighting on this side. My mind immediately goes to, well, how much did this Rudy know? Did he already know that you're killing Jews? Is it, you know, what would have happened if you'd have been a new convert and been this guy and think, well, can I still, you know, I've been taught Jesus, you know. Can I still go for, you know, if you're a new convert, I put myself in that situation thinking, man, can I make that decision? You just say, no, I ain't doing this anymore, because he said, you know. And then another next movie was off the British Isles. These are just tough decisions that I see that people might have needed to make back
right.
in this situation. And so off the British Isle, off of France, 17 miles, is this little island that it's really its own country. It's home, they have their own government. And it's about 60 or 70 miles off the coast of Britain. And the Germans took it, and it was easy because they're not really fighters. And they took all the soldiers away anyway, and so they bombed a few people. And this pilot's trying to romance one of the locals, and you know they won't date the Germans or anything. And he's trying to convince her to. And he said, "Well, what about this? I was just a German engineer. They pull me out, they make me a pilot, teach me how to drop bombs, and say go do it. What am I supposed to do?" And I'm sitting there thinking, man, what if they did that to me? And you got to make that decision. You know you're going to die, especially if you just learn to be a Christian. You know, how can you overcome that? You know, it's just, anyway, I bring that stuff up in those scenarios up in case someday that happens to us. We might have to make a decision, life or death, job loss. There's all kinds of things that can happen. We're just living in this Western Christianity. We've had it. I know we've had our share of maybe persecutions in our life, but, man, nothing like I see during wars like that and stuff. Just when you make a decision to follow Christ, when I read First New Testament for the first time, I realized I might have to make a decision. You know, I used to think I had it pretty good. You know, I'm an only child. My parents take care of me. Everything good. I'm in college. I'm thinking, and all of a sudden I read through the judgment. I'm thinking, man, I don't have to make decisions for Christ. Nobody can help me, you know, except for Him. And I didn't have much faith in Him then. I just thought I was supposed to do everything good enough for Him. You know? So anyway, I just thought I'd throw that out there.
Well, it's true to life, though. I mean, what's that?
Just making a decision to follow the Lord. So I've learned where, in those situations, I don't hold myself to be sure, oh, I overcome it right away. I mean, if I started getting persecuted, because I thought about this time, every once in a while, I think, you know, what if I cave? Well, you know what, I'm going to turn right around, and I'm going to confess my sin, and I'm going to try to be better the next time. Then if it costs me life right after that, so be it. But I don't hold myself to making sure I get it right, or otherwise I'll just quit. It's like, I'm counting on you, Lord, to get me through this. And I may screw it up at first, but eventually I want to get it right. I'm going to call on you, and I want to do the right thing in love and not because I have to be good enough to remain faithful enough
right.
to be saved. You know, or otherwise.
Well, think about this scenario. During some of the persecutions, the authorities would say, if you turn in your Christian friends, you can have their stuff. So sometimes members of the church would turn in a fellow Christian because their faith wasn't all that strong, and they'd get their stuff, and then they would go to jail. And then a decade later, the persecution would end. They'd come out of prison, and then they go back to attend the congregation, and there's the guy that turned them in, leading singing or whatever. It's okay. You know, we think you already know. You're old enough to know life is complicated. You're old enough to know. You just have to trust God sometimes with the way things are. This world is a mess. It's a battleground, and you and I are soldiers. Don't be surprised when the going gets tough. And Jesus is saying, you put your hand to the plow. You better not look back. This is the way it's going to be. But if you give up your life, what are you actually doing? You're saving it. It's just that you have to be able to see that with the eye of faith, not the regular worldly eye, the eye of faith. We good? Lord, love you. Appreciate you all.